Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded, and at this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Kate Harner. Please go ahead.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling into Cigna's 2013 Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of the call today, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you'll be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After that survey, you will be able to ask questions of today's speaker. A handout for today's presentation is available online at www.cigna.com/eating-disorders. Halfway down the page, under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue, entitled When Eating Disorders and Addictions Collide. Again, visit us at the Awareness Series page online at www.cigna.com/eating-disorders. Halfway down the page under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue, entitled When Eating Disorders and Addictions Collide. Please also notice the blue square in the top section of the page that you may click on to sign up for future seminars. It's not required that you sign up in order to attend the monthly seminars. However, if you choose to do so, you will then receive email reminders for each month's presentation. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Kim Dennis. Dr. Dennis is the CEO and Medical Director at Timberline Knowles Treatment Center. Today, she will be sharing information with us on eating disorders and addiction. Welcome, Dr. Dennis.
Thank you so much, and thank you, everyone, for calling in. This is actually National Eating Disorders Awareness Week, so I'm really happy to be giving a webinar on eating disorders. And at Timberline Knowles, one of the things we see very, very commonly is co-occurring eating disorders and substance abuse. And many places will treat eating disorders, but not if there's an active substance abuse problem, and vice versa. And for all the women who have the combination, the treatment options can be limited. So I'm just going to move along through the PowerPoint presentation today, and we'll try to wrap up by 12:45 Central, 1:45 Eastern, so that there'll be some time for questions as well. So I'll start by defining co-occurring or comorbidity. And really what that means is that two disorders or illnesses occur at the same time in the same person. They're both primary illnesses. It's not necessarily the case that one causes the other or vice versa, but they're two distinct illnesses that happen in the same person at the same time. And when the two happen together, the whole disease package, as I like to call it, becomes much more complex, and each of them are tend to be much more difficult to treat. So why might two illnesses co-occur? The research indicates that there are overlapping genetic vulnerabilities, common genetic factors, overlapping environmental triggers such as trauma, neglect, stress, or early drug exposure, involvement of similar brain regions, and for eating disorders and substance abuse, those regions include the reward pathways. Both food and substances of abuse are rewarding in the brain's reward center. Stress responses, which include the what we call the limbic lobes, which affect memory as well as emotion regulation. And then the prefrontal cortex, which is an area of our brains which we use to do things like plan our days, prioritize, you know, what's most important and least important. We also use that area of our brain for impulse control and inhibiting urges. Finally, both drug abuse and eating disorders are developmental disorders. They tend to begin in adolescence or childhood when the brain is very much still in a very malleable, flexible stage, and it's very much in a process of developing. One of the big studies that came out about 10 years ago was a paper called Food for Thought, Substance Abuse and Eating Disorders. And it was this report was done by the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. It was really the first comprehensive examination of the link between substance abuse and eating disorders. And surprisingly at the time, and even surprisingly now to professionals who treat eating disorders or substance abuse and patients themselves and family members, up to 50% of individuals with eating disorders also abuse alcohol or drugs. And this is greatly increased when we compare it to the general population, where about 9% of the population abuses alcohol or drugs. So much higher risk of having a substance abuse problem if you also have an eating disorder. And vice versa, up to 35% of people with alcohol or drug abuse issues were found to have eating disorders. Again, this is a much increased risk than the general population, which we believe to be about 3% of the general population who has an active eating disorder. And the main author of the study said in its conclusion, this lethal link between substance abuse and eating disorders sends a signal to parents, teachers, and health professionals. Where you see the smoke of eating disorders, look for the fire of substance abuse and vice versa. And this is especially so in girls and women. And why one of the main reasons why this is important is that historically, eating disorder professionals, people who specialize and have training in treating eating disorders, have never learned anything about substance abuse or addictions. And vice versa, most people who've been through addiction training programs, whether they're addiction psychiatrists, whether they're addictions counselors or therapists, have never had any training in eating disorders. So in order to be equipped to treat someone who has the co-occurrence, you really need to have training in both. What else do we know from this study? Bulimia nervosa, the purging type of bulimia, is most commonly linked to substance abuse. We also see fairly high rates in anorexia nervosa, binge purge type, and also in binge eating disorder. So any of the eating disorders that are impacted by impulsivity, which we see when there's out of control eating, whether or not that's associated with purging, are more likely to be associated with substance abuse. And the substances are, you know, all across the spectrum. They include alcohol. Many times we see stimulants such as amphetamines and cocaine, some of the medications that people are given to treat ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Many times people with eating disorders will go to a psychiatrist and say exactly what they need to say to get a diagnosis of ADHD and to walk out of that office with a prescription for a stimulant such as Adderall or Ritalin. Benzodiazepines are also commonly abused. Many people with eating disorders are very, very anxious and have high amounts of anxiety. So benzodiazepines would include medications such as Ativan, Klonopin, Xanax. We see a fair amount of opiate abuse, including heroin, caffeine dependency, tobacco. When I talk to women about stopping smoking, invariably the biggest reason they give me for not wanting to stop is fear of weight gain and fear of increased appetite. And then finally, diuretics and laxatives. And basically, these are substances that are being used to self-medicate both negative emotions that they can't otherwise cope with and also obsessive thoughts. The cognitive aspect of having an eating disorder can be the most disturbing for people who suffer. And, you know, we're talking about relentless obsession about calories, about how they look, about their weight, about what they're going to eat, what they're not going to eat. And for many women who have co-occurring substance abuse, they said the only thing that shuts off these thoughts, these constant oppressive thoughts, is to use a substance. Substances are also used to suppress appetite and to increase metabolism. And health professionals, because their training programs have been so siloed and separated from each other, often overlook the link between substance abuse and eating disorders, leaving patients and their families with limited options when it comes to integrated treatment. Some more interesting findings from the Food for Thought study. Advertisers put children at greater risk of developing an eating disorder through the portrayal of unrealistic body images. The average, this was 10 years ago, remember, the average American woman is 5'4" and weighs approximately 140 pounds, but the average model is 5'11" and weighs only 117 pounds. And if we calculate the BMI on that, it puts that average model into a range that meets criteria, at least the weight and BMI criteria for anorexia. I'm going to skip ahead to the next slide. The report showed that only 15% of girls are overweight. So we hear so much in the media about the childhood obesity epidemic and how to lose weight and how to keep kids from becoming obese, and yet only 15% of girls are actually overweight. 40% of girls, however, in grades 1 through 5, so these are tiny, tiny girls, girls that are very, very young, and 62% of teenage girls are actively trying to lose weight. So a way higher percentage than the actual percentage of girls that may, for health reasons, need to lose some weight. And these girls are especially vulnerable to eating disorders and substance abuse problems. You know, one of the biggest risk factors to developing an eating disorder is dieting behavior. Middle school girls who are 10 to 14-year-olds who diet more than once a week are nearly four times more likely to become smokers. Girls with eating disorder symptoms, whether or not they have a full-blown eating disorder, are almost four times more likely to use inhalants and cocaine. And 12.6% of high school students, female high school students, took diet pills, powders, or liquids to control their weight without a doctor's advice. So this is very, very prevalent from a very, very young age, both for girls and boys. It cuts across, you know, all levels of socioeconomic status. It cuts across all races as well, and then both men and women. Women with bulimia who were alcohol dependent, so women who had co-occurring bulimia and alcoholism, had much higher rates of suicide attempts, anxiety, personality disorders, conduct disorders, and other drug dependency than women with bulimia who did not have substance abuse. So the severity, as I said earlier, when there's co-occurring substance abuse with the eating disorder tends to be much, much higher, and the risk of fatality tends to be higher as well. Just want to reiterate one more time, as many as 1 million men and boys also suffer from an eating disorder. So commonly we think of eating disorders as only affecting women. There are scores and scores of men and boys who historically have suffered silently who are now gaining more access to care. And they too have limited treatment options. So what are some of the shared risk factors for substance abuse and eating disorders? Well, we know that both tend to occur in times of transition or stress. They share common brain chemistry, common family histories. Patients who have either substance abuse or eating disorders tend to have low self-esteem, depression, anxiety, and impulsivity. A history of trauma, whether that's sexual abuse, physical abuse, or neglect emotionally or physically, it's fairly common. Unhealthy parental behaviors and low monitoring of children's activities, unhealthy peer norms and social pressures, and then susceptibility to messages from the media. More of the shared characteristics for substance abuse and eating disorders. Clinically, we see obsessive preoccupation, craving, compulsive behaviors, secretiveness, and rituals in both. patients with both eating disorders and substance abuse experience mood altering effects once they either ingest the substance, whether that's substance of abuse or food, or engage in the behavior, if we're talking about eating disorders, starving themselves, binging and purging, binge eating. Social isolation is very, very common. They both are linked to other psychiatric disorders and higher rates of suicide. Both are linked to medical complications, albeit a little bit different for each. Both are difficult to treat and potentially fatal. And both eating disorders and substance abuse are chronic illnesses with high relapse rates. And they require intensive therapy and ongoing care depending on the severity of illness, that will tell you what level of intensity the therapy needs to be. And saying that these are chronic diseases, I also want to say that they're very treatable. People with eating disorders and substance abuse recover and can live happy, healthy, abundant, useful lives. I want to review the definition of addiction and talk about eating disorders as addiction spectrum disorders. Addiction is a word that many people have various associations to, and most associations to the word addiction are not good. So what I mean by the word addiction is, and this is a definition that was put out by the American Society of Addiction Medicine and the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, a primary chronic disease with genetic, psychosocial, and environmental factors influencing its development and manifestations. The disease is often progressive and fatal. It is characterized by continuous or periodic impaired control over using the substance or engaging in the eating disorder behavior, preoccupation with eating disorder thoughts or behaviors or the drug, and use despite adverse consequences. And then finally, distortions in thinking, most notably denial. People with substance abuse as well as eating disorders typically at the outset of treatment cannot see the seriousness of the illness. And that's primarily what we mean by denial. Many times the denial is pervasive. It's not just the individual. Families can be in denial. Healthcare providers can be in denial. The U.S. culture can be in denial. I think we're in a fair amount of denial about how broken our eyes are when it comes to looking at body image, both in women and men. So how do we apply this disease concept to eating disorders? Well, the eating disorders are primary progressive and chronic diseases. Over time, without treatment, they tend to get worse and not better. It's a family disease in that the whole family system is affected by the eating disorder. And the symptoms of the family disease tend to look different for different family members. So a daughter might be exhibiting symptoms of starving herself with anorexia nervosa. The parents might be experiencing symptoms of depression or anxiety or sheer terror that their daughter's going to die if they don't get her help. So that's what I mean by the disease is affecting the whole family system. Both have dependence and withdrawal symptoms. We see in the eating disorders, once somebody stops binging and purging, for instance, they may have some characteristic withdrawal symptoms that might include increased anxiety, difficulty sleeping, headaches. The etiology or causes of the illness are very complex. We know that there are biological, psychological, social, and spiritual aspects. A relapsing course is fairly common. It's the exception rather than the rule for somebody to start treatment on day one and day two, not have any more eating disorder symptoms for the rest of their life. Some of the effects of the disease are irreversible, and the the primary irreversible effect of anorexia nervosa is osteoporosis, which puts young girls and older women at high risk of premature fractures early in their life. They're potentially fatal. The eating disorders have more morbidity and mortality than any of the other psychiatric illnesses. And for anorexia nervosa, the mortality rate is 5% per decade of illness. And it's important to remember, most people think when I ask them, how do people with eating, what's the most common way for people with eating disorders to die? Most people will say a heart attack. And actually up to 50% of the deaths in people with eating disorders occur by suicide. So it's always important to, as a professional, as a family member, to know that that's a potential. And as professionals, we always need to be assessing for that on an ongoing basis. Finally, I want to reiterate the point that full and sustained recovery is absolutely real and possible, both for the patient and the family. What are some of the behavioral similarities between substance abuse and an eating disorder? Loss of control is one of the hallmarks in both. And people, it's easy for people to see loss of control when they look at binge eating disorder or bulimia nervosa, where there's a binging aspect to the illness. And with regards to anorexia nervosa, people with anorexia are completely out of control of their restricting and starvation. They cannot stop doing that behavior all on their own, no matter what it is that they're losing. So I've seen women lose custody of their children. I've seen women lose scholarships. I've seen women not be able to participate in the sport that they love and still not be able to stop restricting food intake with anorexia nervosa. Other behavioral similarities, unsuccessful attempts to cut down or stop the behavior, a great deal of time spent thinking about or engaging in the behavior. When I talk to women early in treatment about their eating disorder and ask, you know, about what percentage of your waking hours are you spending thinking about food or body or weight or calories? Invariably, the answer is 95 to 100% of my time. Continuing despite consequences related to the behavior. Like I mentioned just a minute ago, this disease is so strong that women can lose many, many things in their life before they're at a place where they're willing to get the level of help that they need to recover. More similarities clinically, we see withdrawal symptoms, both with substance abuse and with eating disorders. These may include irritability, restlessness, insomnia, depressed mood, suicidal thoughts. One of the other things that we see with both are women who have trauma histories. Once they stop using the substance, once they stop engaging in the eating disorder behavior, start to experience flashbacks, memories, other extremely overwhelming feelings associated with earlier life events. In both the eating disorders and substance abuse, we see tolerance. And what we mean by tolerance is a need for increased amounts of the substance or behavior over time to get the same effect. So what that looks like for people with eating disorders is a woman with bulimia, for instance, may say, you know, 5 years ago when this illness started for me, I was binging and purging once a week. And now, 5 years later, without any treatment, I'm binging and purging five times every day. In the substance abuse world, what that looks like is, you know, I used to have two beers a day, and now I'm having a case of beer every day. And finally, negative impact on social, occupational, or recreational activities. Both of these are diseases of isolation. And one of the most devastating effects of having an eating disorder is the inability to be in relationships with people that you love. And this plays out in families, this plays out in marriages, this also plays out in occupations as well. there are differences between the eating disorders and substance abuse as well. And the primary difference is the definition of abstinence. And this requires a very high level of clinical sophistication when we're coming up with a definition of abstaining from your eating disorder. We all need to eat. We all need to drink as well, but it's a lot easier to distinguish alcoholic drinks from non-alcoholic drinks than it is to distinguish eating disordered eating from non-eating disordered eating. So people with eating disorders need individualized and very flexible definitions of abstinence. So for one person who's an anorexic who restricts food intake, their definition of abstinence might be eating 3 meals a day and 2 snacks and not skipping any of that. For somebody with binge eating disorder who is addicted to high-fat, high-sweet foods, their definition of abstinence might be 3 well-balanced meals a day and abstaining from foods that are high in refined sugars. So the definition of abstinence is very, very individualized. It's almost like a fingerprint. Body image distortions tend to be very extreme for people with eating disorders. We don't we see this a little bit in women who have just substance abuse and not eating disorders, but very, very extreme, almost to a point of being delusional for women with eating disorders. There also tends to be more of an impact of media and culture on the development of the eating disorder than development of substance abuse. And finally, at least looking at anorexia and bulimia nervosa, a greater female-to-male prevalence ratio for eating disorders and substance abuse. More men than women are diagnosed with substance abuse, and it's just the opposite in the eating disorders. If we're looking at binge eating disorder, we get a little bit closer to a 2-to-1 female-to-male ratio. There tends to be more stigma surrounding the eating disorders, particularly for the obese and for males. There also tends to be less recognition of eating disorder as brain diseases with genetic and biochemical components. Many people view them as just phases, or it's just normal if you're a girl in America. Many people who don't understand eating disorders as diseases will say to sufferers, you just need to eat, or you just need to stop throwing up. People with eating disorders have different physical signs and symptoms than patients with substance abuse. And there tends to be less availability of 12-step or other support groups for patients with eating disorders. There's a very high prevalence of 12-step groups and community support groups for people who are trying to get sober and stay sober. It's much less so for people with eating disorders. One of the treatment modalities we use at Timberline to treat patients who have co-occurring substance abuse and eating disorders is 12-step facilitation, so helping patients connect with sponsors, helping patients find meetings, 12-step meetings to go to give them access to a community, a recovery community that's basically free of charge. We also use dialectical behavior therapy to get at the to arm people with tools that help them interact socially, and that also help them to regulate their emotions internally. Some of the 12-step myths that I come across with doctors and families and therapists and patients are in the next two slides. The most common one is it's a cult, and that members can leave 12-step meetings at any time or programs at any time. There are really no rules. There are suggestions. In that aspect, it's definitely not a cult. And I understand why people might view it as that. The 12-step groups that we use for patients with eating disorders include Overeaters Anonymous, Eating Disorders Anonymous, and Anorexics and Bulimics Anonymous. Another myth, members are told that they will never be fully recovered. And actually, the message of recovery and the hope of recovery is that full and happy living is possible, that the illness will be lifted, and life will come in its place. Another myth, members are forced to stay in a position of powerlessness. And actually, through admitting being powerless over having a disease, it opens people up to the power of recovery, to the power that really lives inside of them, and to live empowered lives. Members are told that they cannot trust themselves, that self-confidence is a liability. Actually, recovery is learning to trust oneself in the context of a loving support of a recovery community, and really learning to connect with self. Both eating disorders and substance abuse are diseases that disconnect people from their true selves. I'm going to skip down to members are discouraged from having therapists, doctors, and other sources of support. There are actually OA as a whole, Eating Disorders Anonymous as a whole, Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole has no opinion on outside issues, and having a therapist or a doctor or a certain meal plan or a certain dietitian, the 12-step program has actually no opinion on that. Members are discouraged from taking medication. There are definitely certain groups within 12-step organizations that may discourage each other from taking medication. But again, as a whole, all of the 12-step programs have no opinion on medication or any other outside issues. It's a religious program. This is another one that comes up very, very frequently. And actually, members are free to develop their own understanding of a higher power or God. It's a spiritual program. It's not affiliated with any structured religion. And members can also belong to whatever religion they want to or none at all. There are specific groups for people who are agnostic or atheist. 12-step meetings don't work for eating disorders because people can't abstain from food or eating. And actually, the 12-step model for eating disorders encourages each person to define what food behaviors or foods constitute abstinence from his or her disease. And again, this is something that's a fingerprint, and that typically a person will come to an understanding of with the help of a treatment team, input from family and friends, and input from a sponsor. 12-step groups like Overeaters Anonymous and Eating Disorders Anonymous won't work for anorexics or bulimics because there are overweight members. We get this very, very commonly when we have our patients go to Overeaters Anonymous meetings in the community, and actually the only membership requirement for a person to go to an OA meeting, there are closed meetings and open meetings. Closed meetings are for members only. Open meetings are for anyone. The only requirement for membership in a closed meeting is a desire to stop eating compulsively. And people with anorexia and bulimia are very, very, very compulsive in the way that they consume food. Another one I hear a lot of about Overeaters Anonymous is that members aren't supposed to eat sugar or white flour. Actually, again, I'll say that there are no rules in any of these 12-step programs, and each person gets to develop her own definition of abstinence and come up with her own meal plan, usually with the help of an eating disorder professional. Some of the tools that 12-step groups use are literature. There are some books that are eating disorder-focused. One that we use a lot here at Timberline is Anorexics and Bulimics Anonymous. It has experience of working through each of the steps and recovery stories as well, which tend to give people a lot of hope. The 12-step meetings, getting a sponsor, doing service work, anonymity, writing and journaling, making phone calls to other people in recovery, and developing a plan of eating or a definition of abstinence are all tools that OA and EDA use. I want to read a definition of abstinence from one of our former residents who did give me permission to use this in presentations. And I want you to just notice that there's very little in this definition of abstinence or recovery about food. Abstinence means waking up every day and dedicating myself to recovery, to taking care of my mind, body, and soul. For my body, abstinence is eating nutritious foods to fuel my body in a healthy way. For my mind, abstinence means actively centering my thoughts and effectively using my coping skills to manage stress and relieve anxiety. For my soul, abstinence means truly being happy. It means that I make decisions that are consistent with my morals and values and take full responsibility for my own choices. And that's, you know, that's somebody that's reconnected to her true self, which is the whole point of recovery. A few more items on eating disorders and drug use. The most commonly abused drugs tend to be amphetamines or stimulants. Cocaine is also in that class. And then marijuana we see quite a bit of with binge eating disorder and compulsive overeating and bulimia. This next slide is represents a emotional eating among individuals who have both eating and substance use disorders. And individuals with both involve the use of using maladaptive behaviors to control or lessen negative or undesired affect. So these are feelings such as intense anger, intense fear or terror, flashbacks from traumatic events, etc. And eating is used for this purpose. Early research on emotional eaters showed that they had a pervasive sense of interpersonal distrust, stemming for many of them from trauma, high levels of perfectionism, a paralyzing sense of ineffectiveness, difficulty identifying emotions, identifying hunger, and decreased ability to communicate feelings. And for all of these, dialectical behavior therapy is a very useful tool to give somebody effective coping skills to deal with those. Back in 1990, Coniglio indicated that up to half of women who misuse substances also suffer from an eating disorder. That was consistent with the Food for Thought report. And people with a substance use disorder eat more after substance intake is reduced and report food cravings. So one of the things that we educate patients and families about is if you have one, you're at a higher risk of either having the other or developing the other once you find recovery from whichever one you're currently suffering with. Adolescents with eating disorders who purge use substances to relieve emotions and get away from their problems. And individuals with substance use disorders and eating disorders use food to regulate emotions. One of the big modules in the big area of treatment focus in dialectical behavior therapy is emotion regulation. So just a few words on treatment. Ongoing medical care is essential. We want to make sure that a person is stable with electrolytes, with cardiac function, with their vital signs like heart rate and blood pressure. Education is another huge piece of treatment, both for the patient and whoever he or she identifies as their support system. 12-step facilitation in conjunction with dialectical behavior therapy, which I've talked about both in the presentation. Family therapy and support is essential for a whole bunch of reasons, especially parents or spouses or siblings of a person with an eating disorder is somebody who's experiencing a crisis in the family and definitely needs therapy and support for him or herself. Nutrition therapy is a huge component of treatment. I tell patients when they first get here that they're most important prescription is the meal plan that their nutritionist puts them on, not any of the medications that I might put them on. Individual and group therapies. Group therapy is very, very important and helps exquisitely with the deep and pervasive sense of isolation that occurs in eating disorders. We use a lot of expressive therapies. Some of these incorporate the body, which is an important key to treating eating disorders. These would include art, equine therapy, dance movement, yoga, canine therapy. And then finally, trauma work, getting at the roots of the illness. We recommend abstinence from alcohol and drugs. We treat any medical complications from the eating disorder or substance abuse. In the refeeding process, food really is medicine. People can't really think in therapy and engage in therapy if their brain is malnourished. Normalization of the eating process is something we spend quite a bit of time working on. Body image distortions. This is an aspect of eating disorders that tends to take longer than any of the other symptoms for people to recover from. Medications. There are anti-craving medications that we use in substance abuse treatment for bulimia nervosa. Serotonin-specific medications have been shown to be helpful. Topiramate or Topamax has been shown to be helpful for binge eating disorder. Many times we'll use a class of medications called atypical antipsychotics to help primarily with anxiety and anorexia during the refeeding phase. And we always treat any co-occurring psychiatric disorders such as major depression, bipolar disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder. With regards to the soul, trauma work and helping patients heal trauma is one of the best ways to give them a shot at lifelong recovery and a really happy and abundant life. There are many ways to go about treating trauma. It's never indicated to start doing trauma work when somebody is active in an addiction or in their eating disorder symptoms. But some of the ways we do that is exposure therapy, storytelling, somatic or alternative therapies, expressive therapy, EMDR is another example. And these are chronic illnesses that require long-term maintenance care, ongoing therapy, ongoing practice of 12-step recovery and DBT skills. Restoration of a life-enhancing relationship with food and body, self and others, and whatever understanding a person has of a higher power, a benevolent force in the universe, a God. And we talk about relapse as relapse forwards or backwards. And a relapse forward is sharing it with your treatment team and people that can help you. Backwards is spiraling back into the disease and keeping that all secret. So there are a few summary slides, which in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over. And I will turn it back over to our moderator to get some questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And to help us evaluate and improve our program, we would ask you to please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in the survey today. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask your questions as well. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Please listen to each question in its entirety before making your selection. Our first question today, the session provided me with a better understanding of eating disorders and substance abuse. If you strongly agree, press star 1. If you agree, press star 2. If you disagree, press star 3. If you strongly disagree, press star 4. And we'll pause for just a moment. Moving on, this session educated me on the shared risk factors of substance abuse and eating disorders. If you strongly agree, press star 1. If you agree, press star 2. If you disagree, press star 3. If you strongly disagree, press star 4. And again, we'll pause. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. If you strongly agree, press star 1. If you agree, press star 2. If you disagree, press star 3. And if you strongly disagree, press star 4. Our fourth question today, I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree. Press star 2 if you do not agree. We'll be right back with our last survey question. Our final survey question today, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Press star 1 for I am an individual with an eating disorder. Press star 2 for I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Press star 3 for I am a health professional. And press star 4 for other. And now we'd like to get to another important part of our call today, which is taking your questions. Thank you for participating in the survey. And if you do have a question or a comment today, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. Again, for questions or comments, that's star 1. And we'll pause for just a moment. And once again, if you have any questions or comments for the doctor today, please press star 1 now. We do have one question. Caller, your line is now open. Caller, if you just press star 1 on your phone, your line is now open. And it appears there are no questions today. Kate, I'd like to turn things back for you for closing remarks.
Thank you, and thank you all so much for attending. I also want to say a special thank you to Dr. Kim Dennis for providing us with such wonderful insights today. If anyone has specific questions about any of the therapies discussed today, please contact the eating disorder team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please also be sure to mark your calendars to join our next eating disorder awareness seminar next month on Tuesday, March 26th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Central, 10 a.m. Pacific. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.
That does conclude today's conference call. Thank you all for your participation, and have a great day.